You are listening to Extinction Radio. Get the podcast at extinctionradio.org.
Welcome to Extinction Radio. I'm your host, Mike Ferrigan, and producer of the show. Extinction Radio is a production of the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. So what do we have for you today? We've got John Compos Cossum, who tells us about his favourite method of fruit preservation, which is dried fruit. We've Paul Beckwith, telling us all about the latest situation in Greenland. Lisa White is here with her emotional and spiritual preparation for what lies ahead due to climate change and habitat destruction. Benji's here as usual, Benjamin the Donkey that is, with his limericks of doom. We also have Peter Melton, who's, I'm going to call this section Juggling and the Quest, which includes a lovely song which Peter co-wrote called How Beautiful the World Is. And last, but certainly not least, we have an interview with the wonderful Jennifer Hines coming up right now. Today's show, we have the incomparable, one and only Jennifer Hines, who is shot to fame as a climate researcher and also as the producer of the two films that are on YouTube, The Arctic Methane Monster's Rapid Rise, and also The Demise of the Arctic. Now, if you haven't watched any of these, please go and watch them because they're absolutely fantastic films. So, great pleasure to have you with us today, Jennifer.
Oh, thank you so much, Mike, for having me on the show today. It's a great honor and a great pleasure.
Did you hear the Peter Wadhams interview?
Well, yes, I did, in fact, and I had the pleasure of listening to it twice on your station, Extinction Radio, and I think it's terribly significant that Peter Wadhams came on to your show, Extinction Radio, on the eve of the publication of his new book, Farewell to Ice, which I have pre-ordered and have not read yet, but I think it's just a significant event that you and Peter had such a fruitful conversation. And also I'd like to note, in case people don't know, Peter Wadhams was forced into retirement by Cambridge. And the fact that they used some age clause to force his retirement at the age of 67 is really not in their best interest, because they've just gotten rid of the premier grandfather, you know, climate scientist of the Arctic region. Well, Peter Wadhams is wasting no time, and he's gone off, and he'll go to Italy now and taking all his research grants with him. So he's moving to Italy to continue his research. But the fact that he came on your show and he was so frank about everything that he's been studying lately and people's reactions to it, and also, you know, health concerns over, you know, some Arctic scientists that have had disastrous, three Arctic scientists died, you know, I mean, this is of concern too, in strange accidents lately, you know, people who are measuring sea ice extent and stuff like that. You know, it's very significant. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the Peter Wadhams interview that you had.
Yeah, I mean, you're correct. Peter was very free-flowing, And he was very relaxed. I've come to know Peter personally a little bit over time. And so we're quite relaxed when we're together. In fact, we're going to be having a coffee up here in Edinburgh together when he's next up. I think it was breaking news, actually, on Extinction Radio, the fact that he's been given the boot by Cambridge University. And I think that says a lot about climate scientists and about universities in general, not always wanting to give out the truth. And I think Peter and his book, I think, was probably what was the final nail in his Cambridge coffin, Farewell to Ice. I think that was just one step too far for them. I find that really interesting. And the fact that he was able to go into the three climate scientists that died under suspicious circumstances, shall we say, and that he was nearly run over in that same time, short time period, by a lorry which climbed up onto the pavement and just missed him. So I just found it really, refreshing. I agree with you. And the feedback I've had is from loads of people on Facebook is that they really enjoyed the interview, and it was, as you say, it was a catch really for us, because I managed to get him on the eve of the production, so it couldn't have gone better.
Mm-hmm. I quite agree, but if you'd like, we can go ahead and continue on the Climate Rodeo Roundup at
yeah,
this point.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, I'd like to kind of focus on the polar regions, both the Arctic and the Antarctic, because everything is happening in both polar regions faster than expected. I mean, that's a phrase we hear in our lives now over and over again. Something's faster than expected, and indeed it is. We find that in the Arctic, things have really taken off in 2016, and in fact, the year started, 2016 started, with a massive tropical sort of rainstorm right over the North Pole. And this is unprecedented. It's never happened before that we know of. And, you know, rain in the Arctic is rare enough. It does happen on occasion, but certainly it never happens mid-winter, which is, in fact, what's happened now. So, you know, all this hot air and rain that happened over the New Year's kind of set 2016 up to be a banner year as far as loss of sea ice extent and loss of sea ice thickness in the Arctic. And just the last 2 weeks, we've had an incredible cyclone. They're almost calling it the Great Cyclone. There was a cyclone in the Arctic and right over the North Pole in 2012 that really smashed up the ice, and it had a huge effect. And in fact, we'll all remember that 2012 was the year of the lowest sea ice extent so far in the Arctic. Well, you know, 2016 is not far behind. And in fact, what they're seeing now is that the sea ice extent in the Arctic is just under the 2012 low mark. So we're tracking number two after 2012. So we expect that 2016 is probably going to end up and be the second lowest sea ice extent in the Arctic. And that has huge, huge implications. You know, just to review, ice and the albedo of ice, albedo is how much reflectivity something has. You know, ice has a very high albedo, and when the ice goes away, or it's melting, or it's at all darker, if it's water and not ice, it's going to absorb a lot more energy. And when this solar energy is absorbed right into the Arctic, then what we find is there's going to be more melting, and we get into the feedbacks, and the feedbacks just continue, and they kind of run away. They're self-reinforcing. And what we find is there's so much self-reinforcing feedback activity going on in the Arctic and in the permafrost area over Siberia now that it's got a momentum all of its own. Siberia has really been a place to note in 2016. Lately, there's just been a huge anthrax outbreak in Siberia, yep. which is very odd. But you know why this anthrax outbreak happened? It happened because there was such a heat wave in Siberia that actually it melted out some dead reindeer that had been encased in ice for a couple hundred years or something like that. Those reindeer had died from anthrax some time ago, and it activated the anthrax virus again, and it started an anthrax outbreak in Siberia. So we can see viral outbreaks from long dead creatures come to life when the permafrost and these places start to thaw out. It's really quite horrifying.
And I believe there was a smallpox found as well.
Oh, was there? I had not heard about that. Well, you know, smallpox was supposed to be, you know, one of the things that we've conquered, isn't it? So I guess it hasn't been conquered after all.
That's right. Yeah. We've talked a bit about the Arctic. What are your feelings about what Peter said, and what you feel about what is going on in the Arctic and the Antarctic? Sorry, at the moment.
Well, the Antarctic is very interesting in that, you know, it's so much bigger. It's solid land, first of all, and the Arctic is all, you know, water. So it's almost the mirror opposite to the Arctic. And it has about, I think, a couple miles worth of ice on top of it. So, you know, it's going to take a lot more energy for the Antarctic to take off. But in fact, we find that the Antarctic is taking off right now with a vengeance. So right now, here we are in September. This is the end of winter in the Antarctic, and a huge tropical mass has just come down from the equatorial regions and set itself right over West Antarctica, and it's causing a huge amount of melting, and this heat is also impacting what is left of the Larsen ice shelf. Larsen A and B have already met their demise some years ago. Larsen C ice shelf has developed a huge crack, and I believe the crack is somewhere in the nature of 130 kilometers long, and it's at least 300 meters wide. So if you can imagine the scale of this crack, it's almost past understanding. Anyway, the bit of ice that's going to crack off, you know, the one that's facing the sea from this crack, is about the size of Connecticut. So what this means, and this ice crack is just growing day by day, and when these things happen, they happen very, very quickly. So when the Larsen C ice shelf begins to crack off, it's going to happen fairly suddenly, and within even 10 days, the whole thing, once it starts to truly crack, will just crack off, and it will meet its demise, and it will be no more. Now, the significant thing about this is the Larsen C ice shelf is like a vast ice plug. And it's holding back a great amount of glacial ice that will now be entrained and start to come down in the West Antarctic region and start to really, really move. Once that ice plug is removed, the rest of the ice behind it is just going to accelerate. And I feel that probably what we're going to see is an exponential escalation of the melting of West Antarctica, which has been melting down quickly, but I think it's actually going to accelerate more after the Larsen C ice shelf dissolves. So we'll have to kind of keep our eyes on Larsen C and see how it does.
I mean, that's pretty scary, but I suppose we should be used to scary things in these end times. But it seems to be everything seems to be going exponential, including probably our emotions and our Kubler-Ross stages that we vacillate through at times. I feel an acceptance. I can't accept that my two children are going to go. That is a bit of acceptance which I find hardest to accept. But, you know, I do vacillate a lot. Depression probably being the main one. Very rarely anger anymore, apart from apart from when I look at the American election.
There's some room for talk there, isn't there?
Well, there certainly is. But did you see the story about those huge pools of water in Antarctica? These huge pools of water. There's this photograph of Antarctica, and I presume.
Well, I did. I remember now that you bring it up. Thanks for reminding me. I made a post on Facebook that Antarctica is starting to look a lot like Greenland, and. Yep. Let me just kind of say what I saw when I flew over Greenland, and we can apply the same to Antarctica. Mm. So when I flew over Greenland in September of 2012, early September of 2012, which, of course, you know, was a very notable melt year up in the Arctic, I was absolutely shocked at the vast pools and rivers and all of the melting that covered the entire portion of Greenland that I was flying over as I was coming back from the UK over to Colorado again. And I thought, oh my God, look at this thing. And the whole thing is starting to break down. And in fact, they are seeing signs that the Greenland ice sheet could begin to start to slip. And they also have seen signs that the Greenland ice sheet has vast pools of water inside of it. So just don't be fooled about what you see on the top, because inside there can be interior lakes. There can be whole lakes at the base of the ice sheet that starts to lubricate it. And, you know, we always think, well, maybe that's just, you know, set to Greenland and it's not really going to be that way other places. Look at Antarctica. It's all nice and stable and white. Well, that's true. At least it was true. But now what they're seeing is that Antarctica itself, especially West Antarctica, is starting to get vast pools of ice on its surface, and it's starting to behave a lot like Greenland is behaving. And in fact, the ice sheet of West Antarctica will start to possibly slip as well. So it's really concerning that West Antarctica is starting to break down so much. But just in case we think that this is just purely relegated to the West, let's take a look at East Antarctica, which has thought to be rock solid stable. Well, that actually is not as stable, and it's just like everything else. You know, when you add heat, ice begins to melt. It's just chemistry. And yeah. In fact, yeah.
What Peter was saying on that one was that in if you take the whole of the Antarctic, then the ice is actually increasing. But that is something to do with some bizarre kind of wind patterns, which is pushing the ice out. And he said, I remember he said that the ice wants to melt, but it's not being given opportunity to melt.
Right. I'd like actually to address that because, yeah. You know, people always say, well, the ice in Antarctica is increasing. But is it really? Because, I mean, take a look. They're mostly talking about sea ice extent. And yes, possibly the sea ice extent may grow and retreat and grow and retreat, but it seems to be picking up a little bit. But let's see what could be possibly melting. When Antarctica is melting and its vast ice sheets are being disgorged into the ocean, they actually sit on its fresh water, and fresh water is lighter than salty water. Even if it's cold and the salty water is warm, the fresh water actually still floats atop the salty water, even if there's a temperature difference. And this is what people don't understand. So the fresh water does not necessarily mix into the salty water. And when you have these vast winds that are actually picking up around the continent, you know, these circular winds circling the whole continent, and it's pushing all this fresh water that's just been melted off of the ice cap back towards the continent and then refreezing. Well, that's not really, that's new fresh water that's freezing. And so it's really an illusion, because if you look at the overall ice mass of Antarctica, it is going down.
Right. Well, it's something which always gets thrown in your face, isn't it? But what about Antarctica? You know, the ice is increasing on there by deniers and stuff. But People often get confused, I think, by the mass and the extent of coverage, and they're completely different things. They forget about the thickness of old ice, and that has decreased amazingly in the Arctic, for instance. You can cover things with a very thin sheet of ice, but that has got nothing to do with the actual amount of ice or the mass, as you put it. I'd like to move on to another subject. There's been a lot of weather happening in the United States.
Hasn't there, though? That's what happens when you have a continent and a country that are almost the same size.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we can actually use the word weather anymore, because weather seems to suggest a sort of a stability and a continuity. I find it's just a difficult word for me to use, whether that has not been manipulated by climate change. And I think all weather now is intertwined with climate change. So what's been going on over there?
Oh, nothing much but a bunch of rain bombs, Mike.
What's a rain bomb, then?
Well, you know, we used to call them rainstorms. Then for a while, I started calling them deluges because I thought, well, a rainstorm's really not going to cover this, you know, if it's not a... So, but now they're calling it rain bombs because the word deluge just isn't, I guess, bad enough. So let's kind of see why would we have a rain bomb. Let's kind of step back and take a look at the atmosphere. And the fact that we are 1.2 degrees Celsius higher is a global temperature than we used to be, say, at the start of the Industrial Revolution. And that last 0.3 degrees, I think, has happened in the last year, and that's shocking. And that's due to the El Nino. The El Nino has really disgorged an awful lot of heat into the atmosphere. So the atmosphere's gotten hotter, and the atmospheric thermodynamics have gotten a lot wilder, too. And part and parcel of the atmospheric thermodynamics is the percentage of rain, water vapor in the atmosphere. The percentage, I mean, it's just chemistry. But for every degree that you go up Celsius in our atmosphere, in any case, you get about 7% more water vapor. So we've gone up about, 1.3 degrees, I believe now, something like that. And we've got at least 7% more water vapor than we used to have at the turn of the Industrial Revolution. But I believe that's gone up. So what you've got now, you've got more heat, like a lot more heat, and then you've got more water. So essentially you have more energy, and you got to imagine the weight of having 7% more water vapor in the atmosphere is intense. And what we're seeing now is the moistening of the upper troposphere. So this is a layer of our atmosphere that heretofore had been rather dry, but now it's getting moistened due to the fact that we've got 7% more water vapor. So that's all science. When you get all this water vapor, and it's not evenly distributed, and so you've got a bunch of this water vapor, a mass of it, and it hits a cold bit, like, say, the jet stream has come down a bit and the water vapor bunch bumps up against it, it's just going to let itself go. And when it generally lets itself go, sometimes it gets lodged, like the one that just happened in Louisiana. Let's talk about that. You know, this big mass of water vapor came directly up from the Gulf, and it got trapped in an area as the jet stream had descended, and it just kind of bumped against it, and it just let itself all go in what kind of looks like a rain bomb. And it just can rain an extraordinary amount. Like, I think they must have gotten 20 to 24 inches in Louisiana in a couple of days. That's really historic. And, I myself was I lived through a rain bomb here in Boulder, Colorado in 2013, I believe it was. And we got 18 inches of rain in 5 days. And I thought that was really bad. But now you can get, you know, the volumes of rain that are coming out of the sky is just astronomical and a little bit incomprehensible. You know, people are just sitting there looking at these vast expanses of waters of flooded land and all their things are gone. And this is a rain bomb. You know, we've had them all over the place. And they can strike big, they can strike small. In the United States, there was a town in Maryland that was basically wiped out because what would have been a normal rainstorm turned into a rain bomb, and it kind of lodged yeah. over a certain area, and it just kind of wiped the town out. But we've had these all over the place.
Yeah, I believe that, you know, there was news coming out that they were the United States, refugees, climate change refugees. And somebody else pointed out that, you know, there's a lot going on in Alaska as well in terms of potential refugees. So there's going to be a lot of refugee situation. But just to finish off the interview, Jennifer, I'd like to ask you a little bit about what you think about the awareness of those people in Louisiana and elsewhere that are having climate events happen to them. And if you think there's any kind of tipping point in their awareness, or if you think the shit has to hit your personal fan at home before you actually go, oh shit, we've got a problem here.
Yeah, climate emergency awareness, you know, when is it going to hit the world at large? Well, what we do know is it's being kept out of the news. I mean, the science is clear. It's very easy to understand. And it doesn't take a genius to kind of go through and see that we are in a state of abrupt climate change right now. Now, people's religious beliefs and their political beliefs may actually shutter them from taking this awareness on board, and that's a personal choice. You know, I mean, if people do not want to look at this, then they don't have to look at this, even if their whole world has been torn apart by rain bombs. And I really can't say for the people of Louisiana if they're going to, you know, if it's going to penetrate that we're in the midst of abrupt climate change. But I do think at large, for people who are thinking people, for people whose minds are open, and for people who have a healthy sense of curiosity and ask the question why, the information is out there. It's very easy to understand. And there's so many videos that are out there. I mean, just Google Paul Beckwith and watch any of his videos, and you will soon start to understand that abrupt climate change is upon us. Whether or not this is going to hit the masses at large, I think it's to a large extent, it depends on the media, because the media really tells us what to think. And right now, the media is not really allowing us to think about this. And this is exactly, I think, why Peter Wadhams was let go from Cambridge. You know, it seems so silly, because I think people are scared. And the best way that they can think to handle it is just to stick the head in the sand and not to look at it, because looking at it is just too scary. And it is scary. Mike, it's very scary. So whether this, climate emergency awareness will come upon us or not, we'll just have to wait and see. But I think it's a large extent dependent on the media and what they're going to allow into the news.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, what I would say probably 95%, apart from, well, that's probably too high, because there's been many countries that have suffered from climate change out with the United States and what I like to call the disunited kingdom for decades now. There have been many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people die due to climate change. And we just kind of see these people as numbers. And that makes me really sad. And I think the majority of the Western civilization will not be given the information on mainstream media. They, even when an event happens, as you say, like Louisiana, they will not necessarily go and connect that with climate change and check it out. Now, what upsets me more than anything about these end times and the doomer groups is, and the media and the politicians, is that you know, they're being misadvised by their advisors, because the advisors, this is what Peter said, don't, you know, they don't give them the right information because they don't want to lose their jobs. You know, they don't want to be accused of being of exaggerating.
I'm up in the UK. You guys have gotten a tremendous amount of deluge activity as well, and I'm wondering if it's tipping over the climate emergency awareness there, you know?
Yeah. You know, personally, we had big floods here a couple of years ago in the south of England, and our Prime Minister at the time, David Cameron, actually mentioned the word climate change. But I think that's all been forgotten about now and pushed under the carpet.
On to the next rain bomb then.
Yeah, I mean, I really do believe that the shit has to hit the fan and we're not going to be given the information. And what I was saying was that what upsets me is that, you know, what governments should be doing now in all earnesty is supporting people in the event of near-term human extinction. And near-term human extinction, I am convinced of, is going to happen. And it's going to happen within the next couple of decades. And what they should be focusing their efforts on is actually supporting the world on getting through near-term human extinction in as gentle a way as possible. And that's, for me, where all the resources should be going. I don't think they should be going into geoengineering. I think it's a fantasy. It's not going to work. It's just going to cause more problems. Mm-hmm. But hey, that's just me. But I know there's a lot of people that feel similar who are on the near-term human extinction support group, for instance, and in other Doomer groups. Mm-hmm. So on that point of me waffling on, I think we've come to the end of our allotment of time. So just Jennifer Hines again, another wonderful interview with you. Very comprehensive as usual. You are now announced to the world that Jennifer Hines is going to be a regular contributor on Extinction Radio, which we're all really chuffed about.
I've happily accepted, and we're going to call it the Climate Rodeo Roundup, with a nod to the Colorado Western culture that I come from.
Yeah, it's a great name for your segment. You know, just to continue, I find you very easy to talk to. I find you very relaxed, and I enjoy your friendship, which is developing. Thank you very much, Jennifer Hines, for
much. Thank you so much, Mike. It's really been a true pleasure. I hope to be on again soon.
Well, you will be. You've got no choice now. You're a contributor.
Yeah, I know. I said yes, didn't I?
Yes, I'll be on your back making sure that you get your contributions in on time. So Jennifer, thanks again. I know you're a favorite on Extinction Radio. So the listening figures will go up when they see the name Jennifer Hines. You are very popular. Anyway, bye for just now.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
You know, you can wipe that frown from your brow. We got here, though no one knows how. But whatever you do, we're not going to pull through. So relax, it's all over now. That's why I listen to Extinction Radio. Yeehaw!
Hello, Extinction Radio listeners. This is Lisa White with another segment for Extinction Radio. And last session, we talked about paring down to essentials and what was in your bug out bag, per se. What relationships are truly important to you? What do you really place a value on? And are you emotionally prepared to move forward during these dynamic times? And that's what I'd like to talk about today, is being emotionally and spiritually prepared for the changes that we have coming due to climate change and also economic and political unrest that is going to be a part of a whole dynamic going on in the coming years. Do you do deep inner work, and do you also do shadow work? Shadow work is looking at those parts of yourself that are unacknowledged, the parts of us ourselves that we choose not to see or we can't see because they're deeply buried in our unconscious. And sometimes those things are not pretty. We don't want to see the bad sides of ourselves. And that's where I feel like our mainstream spirituality movement in the Western world has really been a detriment in our facing climate change. It's over a $10 billion industry every year, and it's based on making people feel good and making people feel positive and manifesting the life of your dreams and being able to control your world instead of participate and respond to the world. And what I found in my journey is that I started a spiritual path because I was in collapse. My world was falling apart. I had just gone through a divorce, and I was in the midst of losing my business and everything I owned. And I wanted to find a way to control the process. So I figured I'd jump into spirituality, learn how to manifest, put all my positive thinking into gear, and make it work and retrieve everything that I had lost. And I spent a lot of time working on those types of things that were superficial, trying to save my life and my comfort and my pride. And what I ended up doing was finding a teacher who showed me how to see my shadow and how to see that side of myself that had built everything around me based on validation and trying to get acceptance and prove myself in a man's world by building a big business and having all the nice cars and a nice home. And that type of thing was appealing to me. I'm a totally different person in that respect now. And I know a lot of people coming into climate change awareness have always been more nature-minded and that sort of thing. But I feel like I had to come into it through my own experience of pro-capitalism in order to feel and experience what others will be feeling and experiencing as we see our climate unravel, which of course is going to be connected into our economic and our political and our social structures. And when we start seeing these structures fall apart, there's going to be a natural gravitation toward fear and trying to control the process, to try to stop it or try to manage it so that it's not uncomfortable. And that's what I was thinking about today when I was trying to decide what to talk about. I really was like, why bother? Why bother? Why should I talk about climate change? Why should I post things on my Facebook page? Why should I even care about what's going on? Because it's not happening in my world at the particular moment. Right now, I'm looking outside and it's a beautiful day and we just had a nice storm pass and weather isn't too extreme and things are good. So why should I care what's happening elsewhere in the world? Why bother? No one else seems to. I can post things on my Facebook page and get two or three likes from like-minded people, but I get more likes for baking cookies. So why bother talking about climate change, and why bother basing my spiritual path on learning how to navigate this particular dynamic in our world instead of just going out and trying to manifest the life of my dreams? And after I thought about it, I just came to the realization that to me, knowing about climate change and having to deal with my fears, my anger, my outrage, my wanting to hide and just go back to the way things were, is one of the greatest spiritual exercises and awakenings that I think I could ever experience. For some people, being spiritual and awakening per se is about ascending this earth and being able to transcend it. But to me, we as souls incarnated into these bodies to experience this particular time in human history, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, and to experience humanity at its most dynamic, diverse, beautiful, horrifying level. We are collectively experiencing what is known in spiritual circles as a dark night. And a dark night can be a time when you are put into situations in your life, whether it's a divorce or an illness or a collapse financially or even a depression because you have faced realities in the world that you don't want to face. And a dark night can give you a choice of how to work with the world and perceive the world. It's not about trying to get through the darkness and make it go away. It's about diving into it and finding meaning and beauty. It's like standing up in the shore where you're standing up against the waves and they keep knocking you down. And after a while, you learn how to dive under the wave and let that flow over you. And going through a collective dark night, we're going to see so many different reactions. We are going to see beautiful connecting moments, and we will see terror, and we will see violence, and we will see corruption and greed, and we will also see so much beauty that we couldn't imagine. And for us to face the times that we are facing, we need to have our practices set and work on our inner selves instead of pointing at someone else and blaming and shaming or trying to find a way to control the situation. The best way we can, quote, control, not that there is such a thing to me, is that we can do our inner work and see our part in this whole collective experience, because we each carry a part of that, and to accept our role, whether we feel like it's been beneficial or detrimental. And part of doing shadow work, and why I believe it's so important, is that if we don't see the sides that we don't want to see about ourselves, if we don't acknowledge our own fears, our own shame, our own greed, our own self-righteousness, our own right way of doing things, then we're going to project it on someone else. And case in point, the U.S. has projected it onto our two political candidates. And we want to point fingers at them, but we've enabled those two people during this time to represent our undercurrent shadow in our society, that part of ourselves that we do not wish to see. And by doing so, we've allowed ourselves to be disconnected, to be more prejudiced, to be divisive, and we need to be able to come together to navigate these times. And not being able to see our shadow is going to force us into more us versus them, or me against you, or I'm right, you're wrong. And life contains both and. We need to see that we can both be beautifully gracious and giving, yet greedy. We need to see ourselves as both happy and sad. And unfortunately, we live in a society that is very polarized. And to me, on an energetic level, I believe this is why we have so much bipolar in our society, is that we have to live these lives of extremes and instead of trying to find a balance between holding light and dark and holding that life is both beautiful and horrifying. And unfortunately, being divisive like this can cause pain. And so the reason why I bother about posting climate change, as in a society of either or, we tend to choose that which makes us feel good. And knowing about what's happening to our climate or what's happening in our political spectrum or etc., etc., that might be unpleasant, is going to be pretty uncomfortable when people finally have to be forced down and into that shadow and woken up abruptly. And I want to be able to be here, whether it's right now or more in the future, because sometimes I think we're a little ahead of ourselves and we're just kind of waiting for people to catch up. But I want to be able to help guide people over that bridge between not knowing and knowing and the horrifying emotions that can come from that. And so I think what I'd like to leave you all with at the end of this segment is to think about what type of spiritual practice you have. How do you connect to yourself? How do you connect to others? Can you see both light and dark within yourself? Do you have to project right or wrong onto somebody else because you can't see your own participation in that particular situation? And being able to see some of the unpleasant parts of our human selves can, if you do it with compassion, can be the most neutralizing experience. It's like throwing an acid on your stomach, and it can help you clear the waters to have better perspective and make better choices in times that are really dynamic and stressful. So think about these things, and if you have questions or comments that you would like to share with me, you can reach me at www.walkinthemud.com. Be well.
Welcome to the Doomsphere Extinction Radio. I'd like to welcome our regular guest, Paul Beckwith, to the show, climatologist Paul Beckwith. He's just come back from holiday, and the first thing he's done is to come on to Extinction Radio. So, Paul, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to sum up the current effects of climate change in Greenland in 5 minutes. So he's starting now.
5 minutes.
Starting now.
Okay. Okay, so it's getting very warm up in the Arctic. We have the Arctic temperature amplification going on because the snow cover is declining and the Arctic sea ice is declining, so it's a lot darker up there. Because it's darker, there's a lot more solar radiation being absorbed, so the Arctic is warming much faster than the rest of the planet. And Greenland, of course, is up there, so Greenland's being subject to this. The jet streams are very wavy and slowing down, and they're bringing a lot more precipitation in the form of rain to places like Greenland and warmth instead of having them subjected to cold Arctic air, which we're starting to really lack. So Greenland's melting extremely rapidly. It's throwing off about 250 gigatons of ice per year. That's the deficit. And we can measure this very accurately from these very sensitive satellites, what called GRACE. You can just Google GRACE, all capitalized, and read about those sensors.
Right.
So the rate of increase, of, if you like, the rate of ice melt on Greenland seems to be doubling about every 7 years or so, every 5 to 7 years ago. Now, James Hansen modeled a 10-year doubling rate, 20-year doubling rate, but he didn't go down to 5. I'm not sure why. I mean, it's closer to 7 from my calculations. So every 7 years or so, the melting rate on Greenland doubles. So what are some of the things that are causing this? Well, there's a lot of different feedbacks in play. The first thing is that Greenland's getting a lot darker, like the rest of the Arctic. It's because of a number of different factors. We're getting a lot of meltwater on forming pools on the surface of the ice, and that's much darker than the white ice. As we lose ice, all of the particles, the sediments, the sands, dust, etc., black carbon, is concentrated. You know this if you live in an area where there's snow and the plows pile up big piles of snow, and then as it melts towards the spring, you see very, very dark and ugly looking snow because of all the stuff, the crud that's in it. So this is happening in Greenland, darkening the surface. We're also getting microorganisms growing in the ice on the surface, and they're making it darker. We're also getting there's concentrations of radiation. There was a paper just recently showing radioactive particles on the ice that are being concentrated more as we get the melt. So all of these things are happening. Some of the meltwater on the surface trickles down to the bedrock. And we call those moulins. And then it goes along the bedrock between the ice and the rock, and it lubricates it, increasing the rate of glacier melt. Of course, there's about 7 meters of sea level rise built into Greenland. So this is a very, you know, it's a very big risk that the sea level accelerates greatly because of Greenland and Antarctica. Remember that Greenland and Antarctica are coupled. So if we get a lot of ice coming off Greenland, raising sea level rise, then that raised sea level rise goes around the planet. It raises sea level rise on Antarctica, lifts up glaciers, causes stronger melting there, and vice versa. Also, the ice is pushing down the bedrock. So 3 kilometers of ice pushes down bedrock about a kilometer. And as you push down, the bedrock that's being pushed down is closer to the core of the Earth. So there's geothermal heating down there, which melts the ice. Because of the high pressure of the weight of the ice on the bedrock, there's high pressure at the bottom at the ice in contact with the bedrock. And when you put high pressure on ice, that melts the ice, as you know, if you ice skate. When you skate, the pressure of the of your skate blade on the ice, it melts a bit of the ice, and you have a thin film of water between your skate blade and the ice, allowing you to skate. So there's all of these different factors going on.
Right. Well, Paul, that was pretty good, mate. I think you must have lectured before.
Yes, I start a class in a few days, introductory climatology class. So, there is another factor. One more quick factor.
Go on then, quick.
Of course, as the ice is melting, the altitude, you know, if you've got 3 kilometers of ice on bedrock, you know, then the altitude is maybe 4 kilometers, 3.5 kilometers is the total height above sea level, and it's cold up there. So as the ice is melting and getting thinner, then it's dropping into lower altitudes where it's warmer. So the more the ice melts, the quicker the melting can become from that feedback as well.
Oh, golly gosh. Oh, great stuff. Well, I think you have successfully completed your mission, and I hope this recording is not going to self-destruct in 5 seconds. So I am looking forward to listening to you on Extinction Radio next time, Paul. And we'll have you on for a main interview, Paul, which will give us 30 minutes to have a good chat, yeah?
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah. Okay, so I shall speak to you soon, Paul, and thank you very much for that comprehensive update about Greenland.
Well, thank you, Mike.
No problem, mate. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
You know, we're sitting here taking our ease and saying whatever we please. Though we can't change our fate, we still like to relate. We're monkeys chattering in trees. That's why I listen to Extinction Radio. Yeehaw.
Hello out there in Extinction Radio Land. Peter Melton on with you this morning, afternoon, evening, whenever you happen to be listening. And today I have a few different things to share, but one of them is this feeling again of the juggling of the grief and the gratitude, this desire to tell other people mixed with this desire not to tell other people, and a quest, a desire to be creative and look for new creative ways that we can help the people who want to know about this to know about it. And so one of the things that I've done, I helped to co-write a song back in 2012 that helps with that. And in this day and age, the song has quite a bit too much hopium to it, probably. So pardon that if it's too much for you, but also I invite you to consider that for people to hear this near-term human extinction message, a lot of them, I have found, need to have just the right amount of hopium mixed in with it so that they can even hear what you're saying. So keep that in mind as we juggle this interesting predicament paradox we find ourselves in. The song is called How Beautiful the World Is. I hope you enjoy it.
Can't believe How lucky I am to be alive. I see redwood trees and mountains, flowing rivers to the sea. I see the same beauty in the eyes of you and me. Can't believe how wonderful the world is. How grateful I am to be alive. But Mother Earth is crying, can you taste her tears? Future generations are depending on us here. 'Cause I can see how fragile the world is. Winds are blowing, storms are brewing, ice is melting, oceans rising, nature's calling, trees are falling, birds are dying, the earth is crying. How bountiful the world is. How awesome it is to be alive. But the way we've been living, we take more than our share. I don't know what we're thinking, if we're thinking that we care. I know the times are scary, but there's a feeling in my bones that we can work together. Make this place our home. Let me be how beautiful the world is. A peaceful planet, let's grow with it. Make it flower, solar power, water flowing, gardens growing, people blowing. Let's get going. How beautiful we all are. How lucky we are to be alive. But our grandchildren are crying, I can hear them weep. If we don't make some changes, what we sow is what they'll reap. Let them see how beautiful the world is. Let us be how beautiful the world is. Let us see how beautiful the world can be.
So here we are. We find ourselves in this very interesting place where we can still see how beautiful the world is, the people, the other species, the nature and plants and ocean and all of it is so beautiful. And yet we have come to the realization that our way of being on this planet is also destroying it, tearing the web apart, unraveling our habitat, if you will, and the habitat for so many other species, and we need to dare to feel into the end. And I was really moved recently by the latest post by Guy McPherson, getting to this place that says, you know, I've said all I can say, and people are going to hear what they want to hear, and the science community has not jumped on this, even though all the scientists or so many of the scientists are saying this is happening, that our media isn't getting on it. Of course, the corporations don't want to get on it, and the politicians that in this blog that Guy wrote called Time to Live, that I strongly invite you to read, he's saying, hey, I've given it my best shot, and I've said what I can say, and it rang true in a lot of ways for me. It's like, there's a desire to talk about this. There's a desire to share this, but there's also a desire not to. And I find myself in a bit of a conundrum. And And here I am wanting to share and wanting to find a way that we can share what's going on without people blocking it out, and find these creative ways to point at what's going on, to begin to say goodbye, to look at this as if, you know, not only have I been given a terminal diagnosis, but the whole way of being and all these other species and all the other people and the future of humanity has been given this terminal diagnosis. And how do we hold that? How does that sit with you? Is it time to start saying goodbye? You know, is that the kind of spark that we could do to help people realize how serious we think this is? You know, attempting to convince people is no longer really a draw for me. But I do love it when people want to know what I think. And like I mentioned before the song, you know, does it take a little bit of hopium? Does it take that little bit of something to help people hear it? You know, we just don't know. And we're dancing this dance for the first time together, but also alone. And one of the things I've done to help me push forward on this is when I say goodbye to somebody, I say, you know, if this is the last time I ever see you, I want to tell you this. And, of course, almost everybody says, oh, well, this isn't the last time I'm going to see you. Don't worry about that. It's like, well, sure, that's the way we've been living. That's the way we've been treating the planet. That's the way we've been treating each other. It's like, I'll have another chance to tell you how I feel. I'll have another chance to really be real with you. But daring to try this has brought up a lot for me and for others. If this is the last time I'm going to see you, then I feel this way. And so maybe that's the sense of urgency and the deep heart place that we can find in this process. Like right now, perhaps this is the last time I ever get to speak or share with you, Extinction Radio listener. And if that's true, then I want to say thank you. I want to say I love you. I feel deeply this connection to humanity and to you. And it's just amazing that we can actually ponder together, whether that's on the phone, over the internet, or on something like this, that we can dare to look at each other metaphorically, if not actually, and say, wow, what an incredible ride this has been. What a beautiful universe. What a miracle that we're here. And wow, what a trip to be sitting here pondering the end of it and knowing that we played a part in creating the end of it and yet still alive in this beautiful world and having to do the dance, the grief and the gratitude at the same time, the joy and the misery. And here we are, one day at a time, living these lives in these interesting times. So I say to you, if this is the last time we speak, wow, what a ride. Thanks for being on with me, and thanks for listening to Extinction Radio.
Hello there, Extinction Radio listeners. This is John Compost Cossum here, speaking from York in the UK. Now, we've just started our autumn season here in the UK, and it's one of my favourite seasons. I think it is my favourite season because it's when all the fruits come in and I can go and pick things out of hedges. So I thought I would do a little piece on my favourite fruit preservation method, which doesn't use any electricity or any chemicals, and it's probably the healthiest way to preserve fruit. You don't need extra sugar with it. It's fruit drying. So I dry lots of fruit. It's a really good way of preserving things in airtight jars. The moths and little animals can't get in there if you've got glass jars with good lids. And these jars can be used again and again. Some people will use mason jars for these. Now, I dry my fruit on the wood stove. That obviously is a thing which will continue going way after the electricity grid has gone down. I'll be able to be heating my house and heating my bath water on my lovely smoke-free wood stove. I dry all sorts of things. At the moment I'm drying pear halves, and apple rings. So the apple rings, I cut them into half and I cut the core out and then I cut them in half again. So each apple makes 4 apple rings. I can dry plums, kiwis. So I sometimes get kiwis out of the composting rubbish that I find, that I get from back of supermarkets. And I dry bananas. Obviously, I don't grow bananas, but I can get bananas very cheaply, or sometimes they're thrown away. So I love drying bananas because dried bananas are delicious. You can dry tomatoes and other things that you might think of as vegetables. Things like mushrooms will dry very nicely. And I don't really dry other vegetables very much, but I do like drying my fruit. Now, there are some fruits which are very difficult to dry on their own. Things like blackberries, raspberries and currants. And these are best used in fruit leather. So fruit leather, what you do is you take your soft fruit, which doesn't dry very well, and you mush it up with something that's like a carrier fruit, like apples or bananas. And then what I do, I tend to liquidise them up until they're a puree, and then I push them through a sieve, and this makes a lovely fine puree, which I then pour into a greased tin or a tin with a liner, a shallow tin. And so you then put that on top of the stove, and over the next few days it dries off, and you can take it out and turn it upside down and dry the underside of it off. And then when it's completely dry and like a sheet of leather, you can then cut it up with scissors, and sometimes you can even roll the strips up. So they're something like a commercial product called fruit winders, which is mixed fruit puree with sugar and preservatives. You can buy fruit winders, but my fruit winders are just dried fruit. Now, there are also some unusual ways of mixing fruit up. So if you've got that raspberry, a load of raspberry juice that you've got out of your garden, what you can do is you can get some dried apple rings and soak the dried apple rings in raspberry juice and then dry them off again, and you get apple and raspberry, the apple rings that are flavoured with raspberries, and they're absolutely wonderful. Another one I do is I dry lots of pears, and then if I've got some lemons or limes that I've found in the compostables, then I squeeze the lemons or limes and I put a cup full of dried pears with a lime or lemon juice, and it soaks up the juice, and then I dry the pears again, and you get the most awesome flavour, the sweetness of the pear, which is almost unbearably sweet, and the tang of the lemon or lime, and that together is just wonderful. So I use these dried fruits instead of sweets. So sometimes I'll have a snack, and I'll have a dried banana as a snack. My children use them instead of sweets. We don't eat sweets in this house at all. We just don't take part in that part of commercial life at all. They just have dried fruit. And I chop it up and put it in my muesli. So I get muesli base, which is just the oats and rice flakes and various other bits and bobs. And I put my own homegrown walnuts and my own shelled pumpkin seeds and lots of different sorts of dried fruit. And that's lovely. So it's very easy to do. You can get an electric dryer. And yeah, I suppose they're okay. You could use your oven, either electricity or gas, or possibly, if you're lucky, a wood-fired oven, and you put it on the lowest heat and leave the door open and dry the stuff overnight. But I favour my wood stove. I love drying food, drying stuff on the wood stove. You can do apples in 24 hours, apple rings in that, and you don't have it next to the stove. You have it where the airflow is maximum, and it doesn't have to be particularly warm air. It has to be moving air. The thing I would like to do, and this is a project for maybe over the winter, is I would like to make a solar-powered dryer. And what you do is you make a box that's got a dark screen at the back, and that absorbs heat. And the box has got a glass front, which means that the whole thing heats up a bit like a greenhouse. And then you put your racks of fruit on in the summer, obviously, when you've got sunlight and warm conditions. And this would be great because I don't dry fruit in the summer because I don't use my stove. So maybe this time next year, I'll be reporting back on Extinction Radio that I have built a solar-powered fruit dryer and that I'm drying fruit, not even using renewable wood, but using the power of the sun alone. How good would that be?
And so ends another edition of Extinction Radio. Thanks to all our contributors and to Jennifer Hines. So from me, Mike Ferrigan, your host and producer, goodbye till next time.